today we're going to go on to Dhammanupassana. We think that the original section of this was the section about the hindrances and the section about the factors of awakening. Now then, there's a problem in the translation. The translation is Dhammanupassana, and it's normally translated as contemplation of the contents of mind. This is because of a commentarial interpretation that arose much later than the original teaching. I think myself, this Dhammanupassana, it says Dhamma. Dhamma has a number of basic meanings in Pali, which are very interesting actually, because they tell you quite a lot about what it means when we talk about the Dhamma. Okay, the Dhamma means the nature of things. That's one very basic meaning of Dhamma or Dharma. Yeah, it means the nature of things, how things are. Later, it becomes like a title for a body of teachings. Yeah, it's the Buddha Dhamma. Yeah, the Dhamma that the Buddha taught. But what he was teaching actually is about the nature of things. Originally, this Dhamma means, it just means how things are. Yeah, it doesn't mean a special body of teachings. As such, there were many Dhammas. In fact, even now there is. There's the Hindu Dharma. Yeah, there's the Jaina Dharma. There's the Buddhist Dharma. Like this. What it means is the Hindu interpretation of how things are. The Jaina interpretation of how things are. Yeah, the Buddha's interpretation of how things are. Yeah. So when I came to do this translation, looking at it and looking at what he's talking about in this section, yeah, I preferred to go back to that original meaning and translate it not as the contemplation of mind objects, which actually doesn't fit into what is here. Mind objects fits into the previous section, the contemplation of mind. The mind objects are things like, you know, those states of mind and so on, like hatred and greed and delusion, all those sort of things, yeah. Those are states of mind. These are actually, on the one hand, about, they're all categories of the teachings. The hindrances, that means the nivarana, the constituents, that means the khanda, the sense spheres, that means the ayatana, the factors of awakening, the bojanga, and the Four Noble Truths, means the Ariyasaccha. Now, all these things are actually categories of the teaching that describe the nature of reality. Yeah, it's not talking about anything else. When we're talking about the five khandhas, you know, the five constituent parts that make up the human personality, that means the, you know, the body, the feelings, the perceptions, or mental processes, and consciousness, it's actually just a description of what makes up a human being, of the important categories that make up a human being. Or if we analyze a human being in a different way, we can look at the sense spheres. That means like the eyes and the ears, this, you know, the nose and the tongue, the body, and the mind, you know, the thoughts that arise on the mind. It's actually just it's an analysis given by the Lord Buddha to look at the nature of reality for a human being. Yeah. But if we understand that the original sections were about the hindrances and the factors of awakening, there is a third meaning for the word Dhamma or Dharma, which is something more like ethical states. And what these two sections are concerned with are ethical states of mind, the things that hinder the mind, yeah, And the things that go towards awakening, the things that are you know, helpful on the path to awakening. So I think actually the original meaning and the original translation should have been the contemplation of ethical states or something like that. But because it's been expanded with all these other categories, we can't use that translation anymore. Like the, you know, the khandhas or the ayatanas, that means the constituent parts or the sense spheres. Those are not ethical states. Those are descriptions of the nature of the person's, you know, state of being in the world. But I think the original meaning was contemplation of ethical states, and that's probably what it would have been. It's because this word dharma is such a broad term, actually. It means many more things. You know, it doesn't just mean these three things. In fact, there's kind of like, you know, if you look in the dictionary, there's like a list, you know, like a paragraph long list of different meanings. So just to understand what this Dhammanupassana is really about, yeah. Just to understand the meaning. Very difficult, you know, actually being a translator, because some of these terms have such a broad meaning, and in English, we don't have those meanings. We have to say this or that, but in Pali, you don't. You say dharma, and it means this and that. It means both ethical states, nature of things, and a body of teaching. Yeah? The one word means all that, but in English, we have to choose, you see. So we choose between this, that, and the other. It's a terrible life. You know, terrible life working as a translator, because we're constantly stuck with this problem. There's many other words like sankhara. It's the same problem, you know. So many different meanings for that word sankhara. And then how to get it across, you know, is actually very difficult. This one, by the way, I'd like to say, this is one very good reason why some knowledge of Pali is absolutely essential for understanding the original teachings. Not that you have to be able to read everything in Pali, but if you know just some of the most basic and important terms and what their connotations are in the original language, and then use that to work through the English or the Chinese or whatever it is that's your easier language to study the teaching in, then, you know, you will understand that when one word is spoken, it might have a whole range of meanings that cannot be put into the translated language. So even if you know some of these key terms, yeah, it's a really, really big help in understanding what the teaching was really about. It's not beyond anybody, okay? You don't have to learn a huge vocabulary or a grammar or, you know, any of these sort of things. I think even if you learned let's say the basic meanings in the original language of, say, 50 terms, you know, 50 is not a lot. That's what I think. Okay, if you understood those 50 terms and were able to, from a translation, work back to what the connotations were, it would really be a big help in understanding the teaching. So we'll go to the first section. So contemplation of the nature of things. The section about the hindrances, it's nivarana. Is the word in Pali, nivarana. There's a lot of words with this vara in. It always means kind of restraining or hindering or preventing. That's the basic meaning of this thing. You've got nivarana and samvara. All these words come from the same root. So he says, here, monks, a monk dwells contemplating the nature of things in various things, in the five hindrances. I'll just give you the outline of the first one. It's actually quite long, of course. But I'll just give you the outline of the first one, and then the others we can just see. That you can just actually, interchange the terms. Yeah, once you understand the outline of what it's about, afterwards you can interchange terms. Here, monks, a monk having sensual desire in himself knows there is sensual desire in myself. It's very similar to what we were looking at earlier with the contemplation of mind. If there's sensual desire, to know that there's sensual desire there, or not having sensual desire in himself, he knows there is no sensual desire in myself. This is what we were talking about earlier with the contemplation of mind. But here it goes on from that, and this is the important part in this section, in this Dhammanupassana, not just knowing the state of mind, how there is an arising of sensual desire that has not arisen. The thing is, in Pali and in Sanskrit, they always work with negatives. So this is one of these cases, you know. So you have to try to follow it, you know, working with these negatives. How there is an arising essential desire that has not arisen, that he knows. And how there is an abandonment of sensual desire that has arisen, that also he knows. And how there is a non-arising of abandoned sensual desire again in the future, that also he knows. Because this is the pattern for all the qualities that is going to be discussed, not only here, but also later. It's a little bit different in the Bojangas, but also this sort of pattern comes again later. Now, this sensual desire, it's in Pali it means karma chanda. Karma, it's K long A-M-A, not K-A-R-M-A or K-A-M-M-A. It's not actions, not deeds, but sensual desire. You know this, do you know Kama Sutra? People don't know. You know, yeah. Okay. So Kama Sutra is actually a manual that was written in the Middle Ages about lovemaking in India. It's written in High Sanskrit, Kama Sutra. So it's this karma. Karma is also one of these words that is very interesting in the Pali, because its broad meaning is actually sensual desire. So that means any sort of sensual desire, you know. The fact of the matter is that the senses that are attracted to certain objects, yeah, and they're repelled by other objects, that comes later. But they're attracted by certain objects, and it gives rise to sensual desire, which also creates something like an imbalance in the mind. Its narrow meaning actually means sexual desire. Yeah, because sexual desire is actually like the epitome of sensual desire. The most strong form of sensual desire is actually sexual desire. Yeah, you know, actually, it's karmesu michachara, we say in the third precept. That's also karma, you see. Karmesu is the locative form. It means in sensual desires. Karmesu michachara, we say that as the third precept. That's the same karma. It means actually that you shouldn't have sexual relations with somebody who is under the protection of somebody else. That means they're still under the protection of their parents or of their husband or wife, maybe, like this, or of a guardian or something like that. Yeah. So these are the kind of connotations of it. Because what happens is, when these qualities of mind arise, they give rise to an imbalance in the mind. Yeah. And then you do things that you wouldn't do otherwise. You wouldn't do in a kind of more rational time. Like, for instance, a man might, because of sexual desire, a man might commit adultery. But in actual fact, when he thought about it later, he might not wanted to have done that. He might love his wife completely and be really feel terrible about it. But because the mind has become unbalanced owing to this sensual desire, he does something that he later regrets. Now, we've all done things that we later regret. They're done, actually, in every time, basically. They're done under the force of defilements. Those defilements overcome the mind, and then we act on it, and later we regret it. So these are the kind of qualities of mind that we're talking about here. These are actually a specific set of qualities, but we can understand it broadly, you see. It's better to understand these things in a broad way. These qualities that they're actually talking about, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, agitation and worry and doubt, are actually the five hindrances that prevent a person from attaining samadhi. Yeah. That prevent a person from attaining high levels of concentration. But we don't have to understand it just meaning in that sphere. Yeah. Anywhere that the defilements exist, we should know that they're arising. Yeah. We should be able to recognize when our minds have got defilements in them and when there are no defilements in them. But this is the important thing. How there is an arising of sensual desire. Yeah. In this third line here. How there is an arising of sensual desire. In a way, I think most people don't really understand how their minds work. You know, what causes all these problems and all the suffering that they have? Yeah. They don't really, because they don't really understand the mind. They don't understand about defilements. They don't understand about delusion. They don't understand the teaching. They don't understand how to analyze all these things. Yeah. Then they don't know how it has arisen. Yeah. They don't know how that they can abandon it. Yeah. They just act. The defilement overcomes the mind and they act on it. But this is really important to understand how the defilements work, how the defilements overtake the mind, and then what they can what they can do to you, and what the repercussions of all that is as well. Yeah, because when the defilements overcome your mind, it's not a personal thing. Yeah. Initially, it's a personal thing. But let's say you're overcome by hatred. Yeah. Then you get angry. Then you shout at somebody. The hatred doesn't stop here. Yeah. It doesn't end in your mind. It's not just a personal problem. It's a problem that infects everybody else. And everybody knows this as well. When you get angry, it tends to make other people angry. They have the same response. The people who, when somebody gets angry, can remain patient and quiet and understanding and gentle, it's very, very few. Normally, if somebody comes in, like you go into work in the morning, right, and the boss turns around and says, you know, why did you lose that order? Whatever it is. Or why did you lose that customer? He's angry. And then you get angry. You get angry with him and you think, what's he to say that to me? All the things he does. How many customers has he lost? Like that. So, you see, it's not just a personal thing when you've got defilements in the mind. It actually infects everybody else in the community. Everybody you're in contact with. That's why it's really important to understand the defilements and understand how they work, because it's going to be operating in you, not only in yourself. Of course, it's a disaster in yourself. If your mind is overcome by defilements, that's it's a real disaster for your mind. Yeah. It's like a real pollution. In fact, those three that we were looking at earlier, greed, hatred, and delusion, they're called asava. Asava, the real meaning is pollutant. And asava is, they use it in a different way in Pali to mean like what happens when a river overflows its banks and then pollutes all the rice crops. Yeah. Or when you get a boil, something like a boil, and then all the fluid comes out. That's also an asava. That's another way it's used, you see. It's polluting the area on the body. Yeah. This, though, in the technical term that we're talking about now, this is the pollution of the mind. All of these defilements, whatever kind that they are, they're actually polluting the mind. They're making it ugly, you know, incoherent. If you've got wholesome qualities in the mind, those are beautiful states of mind. It's really wonderful, actually. It comes in the Abhidhamma, you know. The Abhidhamma is often called like a mountain of dry bones because it's like a scholastic analysis, you know. So you don't expect something, in a way. You don't expect something in a scholastic analysis or something like that to talk about beautiful states of mind, but that's what it talks about, you see. So the defilements are the opposite. They're ugly states of mind, yeah. And just like the girl who gets up in the morning and then, you know, she gets in front of the mirror and then she tries to make herself look good, yeah. She wants to look good. In the same way, a boy will do it as well, of course, not just girls. You know, the boy gets nicely dressed up because he wants to impress the girl. The girl gets nicely dressed up because she wants to impress the boy. Nothing wrong with that, in fact. You want to make your best appearance. I think actually that's a good quality. If you've got that in mind, you know, that you want to make a good appearance, then what you really need is beautiful states of mind, yeah, beautiful qualities in the mind. There's an interesting thing. I got this from Ajahn Brahm. So Ajahn Brahm knows so many good stories. But there's an interesting kind of poll that was made in Australia, and they asked young people, what is really attractive about the opposite sex? What do they find really attractive about the opposite sex? So you might expect, you know, tall, dark, and handsome, or you know, or very pretty, or something like that. But what the majority of people actually said was, if people are virtuous, yeah, that is the most attractive quality. I think it's really wonderful. If they see somebody is virtuous in their behavior, yeah, that's what really attracts people to each other. Yeah. I think that's really wonderful if you understand that. Yeah. Everybody's trying to dress up their body. Yeah, but what you should be doing is dressing up your mind. You know, producing good qualities of mind makes you really attractive to everybody else. But not only just between the sexes. It's also between friends. If you know somebody who is really virtuous, you're attracted to that person. If you know somebody who is really unvirtuous, yeah, you're repelled from them. It pushes you away. You don't want to go near somebody who is, you know, always doing really wrong. Now, I know another story, and this is also a really telling story. There was once, it's like a mole. Do you know what a mole is? A gangster's mole. So a mole is like a young lady who hangs around the gangsters. Yeah, and you know that's what their life is. So there's this interesting story of one woman, young woman, I think in her early 20s, and she went into the bar where she goes, you know, normally goes every night, and she looked around and she realized every single person she knew in that bar was a hired killer. It's really horrible, isn't it? But the thing is, she realized it. That woman knew what her situation was, and she turned away from it. Yeah. She's now one of the top Zen teachers in America. But originally, she was a gangster's mole. Right? But it's just getting that chance and understanding what is really happening in the mind. She did it one time. You know, not a really terrible situation. She just realized everybody I know is a killer. And converted. Yeah. Turned away from that sort of life into another sort of life. And she started meditation. She didn't just, you know, instantly become a great Zen teacher or anything. So also, I think for many people who were, let's say, not born in a Buddhist background, or maybe were born in a Buddhist background but were not practitioners. I can remember in the past, you know, I mean, I'd done all sorts of wrong things. You know, everybody who has not been brought up in a kind of virtuous family or a virtuous background, I was brought up in a kind of materialist background. They've done all sorts of bad things, yeah. And later, they've understood that situation, yeah, and they've been able to change from it and start doing, you know, some good or whatever. So there's lots of cases. They're kind of called, in Malaysia anyway, I understand they're called Angulimala cases. So everybody knows the story about Angulimala, you know, who was also, in a way, a hired killer, you see. He had to pay his teacher. Yeah, his teacher asked him for 1,000 fingers, you know. And because he was obliged to pay what his teacher asked him, he started killing people and chopping off their fingers. And then he started wearing them round his neck. Yeah. Anguli means finger. Yeah. Mala means like a garland. So Angulimala, it was actually a descriptive term. It's not his name. His name actually is, interestingly enough, anyway, in the tradition, his name is Ahimsaka. You know Ahimsa? Well, Gandhi was teaching Ahimsa. It means non-violence. So he was, his given name means the non-violent one. That's what his name was from his family. Delusion. Delusion makes you do things. It makes you act in a way that you wouldn't act if you were just, you know, in a more balanced state of mind. Yeah. So you can do all sorts of things. That's why it's important to know what is going on in the mind. You must know the qualities of mind. Don't just ignore them. A lot of what people want to do is they get angry, and there's a tendency, for instance, to think, yeah, I got angry, but that's not really me. Yeah? That's what people tell themselves, isn't it? Yeah. I got angry, but that's not really me. Really, I'm a nice guy, you know. Anger is an incidental thing. In a way, it's true, of course. It is an incidental thing. But it's that incidental thing that makes you do something that you shouldn't do. But if you have this teaching in the first place to understand the states of mind that are arising, whether they're there or they're not there, and then how they arise, what gives rise to all these unskillful states. For instance, it's quite common, you know, when people start meditation, that they get really deep insights into their past life. Not into their past lives. That happens as well sometimes. But just into their past life. Things that they've forgotten in the past. I remember a really interesting example, you know, when I was with Godwin at Nilambi. There was a German woman come in, and she'd not done meditation before. And it's fairly intense at Nilambi. You're basically in silence for about 23 hours a day. The sitting practice is only about 6 hours a day, so it's not, you know, it's not leg breaking or anything like that. But the silence is quite intensive. Within a couple of days, this woman was just, so much was coming up from her past. And, you know, one thing she remembered is her father had tried to kill her when she was 9 or 10 years old. She was then about in her late 20s, something like that, I would say. And she'd completely forgotten about that. But she had all sorts of neuroses, you know. But she'd completely forgotten how that had all started. Her father one time had come in drunk or something. I think it was actually he'd come in drunk and he tried to kill her. That was such an horrific event for her, she could not admit it to herself. Yeah, you can understand the situation. So what she did was suppress it. Yeah, push it down into what we say the subconscious, okay? She pushed that down into the subconscious and she completely forgot about it. But that had so much power over her life and was made her so neurotic, you know. She was very afraid of men. Of course she's very afraid of men. Men, you know, a big, powerful man tried to kill her. But she doesn't know why she's afraid of men. Yeah. Now this mechanism is what we're talking about here. How there is an arising essential desire or ill will or whatever like that. Yeah. This is one part of it anyway, you know. There's many things that have happened in our past that we've tried to cope with in an unskillful way. Like it's unskillful for this woman or girl, as she would have been at that time, for this girl to suppress that information because that information still has control over her. And she can't do anything with it. She doesn't know why she's acting the way she's acting. And it's the same with a lot that people do. That's an extreme example. So you always have to give kind of extreme examples like the gangster's mole and things like this. You give extreme examples. But if we look back ourselves, we can find this also in our own lives, you know. Maybe, for instance, our parents spanked us. Okay, they didn't try to kill us, and when they spanked us, we had a, you know, some sort of reaction to that. And now, by now, we've forgotten what that reaction is or why we're acting. Like some people, when they're attacked physically by their parents, say, some people, what they try to do is run away from it. They try to get into another room. Other people, their inclination is they fight back, right? They learned it in childhood. A lot of times, they learned that in childhood. And now, exactly the same patterns arise again and again and again. When somebody attacks them, yeah, they attack back. Or maybe they've got a different way of dealing with it. They run away, and they run away, and they run away. But they don't know what the origin of all this is. Yeah, they've lost track. It's just like this woman, in the more extreme example, couldn't remember that her father had tried to kill her for all that time. So the thing is that we can understand, that's what, just one way that these things arise, but we can understand how things arise. One important part of doing meditation, this is all about meditation here. So one important part about meditation is understanding how these different mental states arise. Yeah. Okay? That's the third sentence. First one is knowing that it's there. Second one is knowing when it's not there. Also important. You must know when you're not overcome by defilements, and then understanding how defilements arise. So another section on how defilements arise. If you put yourself into the wrong types of sense contact, yeah, that will provoke certain states of mind. Yeah. There's actually big arguments about this, but I don't see any argument about it at all. There's big arguments about it in this thing. They say, for instance, that people who are exposed to violent films do not necessarily become violent themselves. Of course, it's true. But if you expose yourself to violent films, you're more inclining your mind to violence than if you don't. And a lot of the people who have been involved in these kind of school shootings and stuff like that, what is it, you know, kind of killing people without kind of any proper reason or anything like that, all those sort of things, if you look in their background, what they've actually been doing is watching all these violent films. Yeah. And then, because of the influence and the influence and the influence, not everybody would have that reaction, but, you know, a good number of people will. And other people, their minds will be tainted anyway. Yeah. They will more inclined towards violence. Or if you've got somebody who is, say, addicted to pornography, not everybody who is addicted to pornography is going to turn out to be a rapist. Yeah. But if they're always putting input into their minds, provoking sensual desire, yeah, if they're always doing that, then they're first of all, they're polluting their mind, and secondly, they're inclining their mind to act on provocations of sensual desire. They're more likely to act on it. They're more likely not just to become rapists, but to become adulterers or whatever, because they're polluting their minds. They're exposing their minds to all these different things. So another section is not just what has happened in the past, but also what people are doing in the present. So that's also why you have to be very careful about what you expose the mind to. Actually, you see, there's other ways that it can happen as well. If you go to war, yeah, you know, you sign up to the army, and then you go to war, right? And everybody is killing. Yeah. It's more likely that you're going to kill, because everybody is killing. There's all sorts of killing. They're killing you, and you're killing them. Your friends are getting killed. Their friends are getting killed. And you're more likely to act on it. So your life circumstances are also important. If you're trying to control the nature of the mind, yeah, you also have to control the nature of the environment. If you expose yourself to all sorts of bad things in your environment, then you're polluting your mind, you're inclining your mind to get those sorts of things arising. Yeah. And when they arise, you're likely, more likely, to act on it. So environment is very important. It's one reason, really, why, you know, monastics, they give up family life, they give up business life, they give up, you know, the normal sorts of things. Because in the normal sorts of things, there's all sorts of problems arising. In family life, you know, if you're having a normal sexual relationship with a partner, well, lust is going to be rising in the mind. There's no way of avoiding it. Say you're in business and you have to outdo your competitor. Yeah, it can be a form of hatred arising. You know, you want to put down your, you know, your competitor and put yourself up. Yeah. So those sort of things can arise. Actually, they arise in the monastic life, but not normally the sexual thing. But the you know, you get rivalries between monks as well. That can also happen. You know. But anyway, just leaving that aside as kind of like idealistic thing. That's why monastics leave behind family life. They leave behind business life, and they go and live in a forest. You know, in the forest, actually, generally speaking, you know, things are fairly peaceful. Yeah. Your environment is more conducive. Same actually for lay people when they go to meditation centers. Why do they go to a meditation center? They go there because the environment is conducive. Yeah. The situation has been set up for you. Yeah. So you go there you know, naturally the mind quietens down. There's no TV. Well, it's true. There's no singing. There's no dancing. There's no, you know, gossiping. In fact, you can't talk. A lot of the times you go to the meditation center, the first thing they tell you is no talking. Right? Because people can control their bodies quite well. Most people, but they can't control their mouths. It's really true. As soon as they open their mouth, they say something bad, or so, you know, they start talking about somebody or something like this, you know, or they tell a fib or something, you know, like this. So, you know, the first thing they tell you when you go to a meditation center is no talking. There's always big signs up saying silence. And then, you know, all the kind of normal sensual inputs are also brought down. You only eat twice a day. And it's not very, you know, it's not very interesting either. It's not what you cooked yourself, for instance. You don't get the choice. Yeah. When you get a choice, you know, you start salivating. Yeah. You cook what you like. Yeah. But when you go to a monastery, you don't get what you like. You get what other people like, which might not be what you like at all. Okay, so also, then, you know, the inputs come down, stabilize and everything like that. Then you've got a conducive environment. When you've got a conducive environment like that, then you can actually turn the mind inwards and look at what's going on. Yeah. A lot of the problem of trying to do meditation in the, you know, what we call the real world. Actually, in fact, it's not real. But what we call the real world, like that means people's everyday life, is there's just too much input. Yeah. They try to sit without any previous practice. They try to sit at home. The kids are crying. Their mother's calling them. You know, their elderly mother's calling them. She needs to go to the toilet or something. She can't go by herself. You know, it's... The neighbors are arguing. The television is on. There's music playing across the street. There's just too much going on. Yeah, really, if you want to do meditation properly, first of all, try and get on a retreat. I always tell people this, yeah. Try and get on a retreat. When you've got on a retreat, and you've got some experience, yeah, you will know what you're aiming at back in your home. Yeah, you will also have some sort of idea of how to let go of the things that are arising. Like even in a monastery, it's not 100% good environment. It's actually normally like 60% or 70% or something like that. There's always people talking, dogs barking, or something going on. But it's much less than it is in your normal lay life, you know. And and what you're doing in that environment is learning how to deal with the mind, learning how to cope with the mind. Yeah. That's the third section, is knowing how these things arise, what gives rise to different qualities of mind. And then how do we abandon it as well? Yeah. You're not only going to know how these things arise, but what do you do when these things have arise? But until you're at a very high stage of development, still you get these qualities of mind. Until you're at the stage of, you know, anagami or arahat, right, you're still going to be getting sensual desire, you're still going to be getting hatred, and certainly you're still going to be getting delusion. Yeah. So you need to know how to abandon them as well. Yeah. Right. Now, in fact, in the last couple of talks, we talked about this quite a lot. So I'm just going to say a few things now, because we already talked about this so many times before, but there's new people here, Right. One way you can do it is that you oppose opposites with opposites. If hatred arises, you change from that hatred, you change the mind to loving kindness. How do you do it? Everybody, you know, say somebody has said something bad to you, right? Your tendency is to focus on what he said, and you don't see the whole character. Yeah. You know, it might be your father, for instance. Your father just scolded you. Yeah. And then you focus on the scolding that has gone on, right? And you forget about all the good things that your father does, right? So what you do when you want abandonment of these, you know, hateful mindsets is you get distance from it. You get a little bit of distance and you try to see the big picture. Okay, he got angry now, yeah? But, you know, all his life he's been working on my behalf, trying to give me a good education, trying to bring me up properly, trying to, you know, sustain my life, look after not only me, look after my brothers and sisters, look after my mother, and all this. Yeah. You try to step back from just this one quality that has arisen that you don't like, and you see the big picture, and then you look at something that is good in that person. Yeah. And then you develop loving kindness for those good qualities. Yeah. Not loving kindness for the bad qualities, of course. Yeah. You don't want to promote the bad qualities. You want to promote the good qualities. And that also has exactly the same effect. Just like when you're exposing your mind to anger and hatred all the time, you give rise to anger and hatred in other people. When you give rise to loving kindness all the time, you give rise to loving kindness in other people. It's like the law of attraction. If you know this thing, the law of attraction, like attracts like. So if somebody says something nasty to you, your tendency is to get angry. That's kind of a natural thing. You should understand that it's a natural reaction. But the thing to do is to give rise to patience, yeah, to give rise to acceptance, to give rise to loving kindness, these sort of things. If you don't react with the same bad quality, but you react with an opposite quality, the chances are that the person who is aggravating you, yeah, his mindset will change as well. Yeah. If you are, he gets angry and you get patient and you get understanding and you get kind, the chances are he will calm down. Yeah. Right. So that's skill. Yeah. That's skill. Mainly, we are acting unskillfully. Somebody gets angry and we get angry. It doesn't solve the situation at all. Another thing is when somebody gets angry, we never look to see if they're justified. We always react and think they're unjustified. Whatever they've said, they may have said it in the wrong way, but they might actually be saying something true. They might scold you for leaving the doors open all the time. Or something like this, you know, so petty. But it does, just try to think of an example. But they might scold you because you're always leaving the doors open all the time and the dog comes in and, you know, sits on the bed and all this sort of thing, whatever it is, you know. So, you know, it causes a disturbance and a nuisance. But when they scold you, you just react to it and, you know, you get angry with them. They get angry with you, you get angry with them. But in actual fact, if you look at it, maybe you should actually have closed the door. If you see, you know, that there might be some justification, also you can calm down and you can abandon your, you know, your anger or your, you know, the defilement that arises in your mind. Yeah. So understanding the other person, keeping patience with the other person, just on ill will now, you know, keeping patience with the other person, looking for good qualities in the other person. Same with the next one, sloth and torpor. You know, some people are by nature, you know, they're not very You know, they're not very energetic. There's certain people, just their nature is like this, you know. They just hang around. They never kind of get up and do anything, you know. They don't even look after themselves. Yeah. They can't even look after their clothes or, you know, their hair or or whatever it is, you know. They're just slothful by nature. So how do you oppose something like that? Then you have to produce energy. You have to understand that being slothful and being like, you know, completely without any kind of ambition or anything like that is not always a good thing. Yeah. To actually look after yourself, you've got to have some energy to do it. So you produce energy. That's producing an opposite to an opposite. Yeah. You see that these qualities of mind have arisen and you produce an opposite. So the next one is agitation and worry. We had a question about worry a couple of talks ago. So one lady who came and was, you know, she was saying she was constantly worrying. Actually, worry is a defilement. Yeah. Worry is a defilement. Don't give rise to defilements in the mind. It's really never going to be helpful. Yeah. If there's agitation about things, if there's worry about things, it cannot help the situation because it's changing the nature of mind in an unwholesome way. Yeah. For somebody who's worrying about somebody else, like I forget with that woman what she was worrying about. I think with her children or something, you know. Her children are not behaving, you know, in the way that she would like, you know. Like this, but that doesn't help the children that she's worrying. Yeah, but it would help the children if she put that worry aside and looked what she could do to help them. Yeah, all that mental energy spent on the defilements. In fact, all of this, you know, it causes an enormous amount of wastage of mental energy. All the defilements do the same. So if you don't give rise to these defilements and you use the energy in a much more practical and wholesome way, yeah, you can get the result that you wanted. That's an important thing to know. So these are five hindrances. Just take them as examples. Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, agitation and worry, and doubt. Doubt is also really a hindrance. It's really a terrible hindrance. Like a lot of people, especially as monastics, we get this a lot of time. People come and they have doubts about the teaching. Now, of course, if you've got a doubt, go to somebody who can explain, you know, and can put aside your doubts. But a lot of people have doubts and they just live with those doubts and they keep them and they just kind of stew, you know, they kind of stew in their doubts. They just think, I don't know about rebirth. Maybe there is rebirth. Maybe there's not rebirth. And so, you know, you know, they don't have any faith in the actual teaching or anything like that. And then, you know, that doubt is also hinders them because they're spending mental energy in a way that is not useful. It's not helpful. It's not going to produce any good state or any good quality or anything like that. They're wasting their mental energy on all these bad states. And people do it. Actually, even if you go home tonight and you look, I mean, I don't want you to just kind of focus on defilements. Now we're going to go on to the next section, okay? But if you look and you just think back, when you go home tonight, just try and think back about when you had like a strong feeling of hatred. Yeah, I often give this as an example, you know. When somebody says something bad to you, yeah, that person hurts you once. And you take that bad thing and you repeat it and you repeat it and you repeat it and you repeat it to yourself. That person hurt you once. You hurt yourself 100 times. Huh? Right? Wasting your mental energy. That's what you're doing. Now, if you look, just look at your own life and see how much mental energy you wasted. Yeah? Somebody did something that hurt you, and you just kept beating yourself and beating yourself with it. Right? You're doing your enemy's business for you. He hit you once, you took the stick and started hitting yourself. It's true. You just look at it. Now, when you go home, you try and think about this, right? And when you think about it, try to, you know, come to the resolution that you won't do that again, right? Don't waste your energy, right? Next time when somebody hurts you, right, be more skillful about it and try to find out ways that you can deal with that situation to, first of all, abandon the mental quality that has arisen, yeah? And then when you've abandoned it, how you can change the situation with the person. Yeah. If you change the situation with the person, like you become friends with the boss, you know, so you become friends with the boss, then he's going to be good with you. You're good with him, he's good with you. Law of attraction.